So this is based on this old idea of Harvey Moore in 1996. So the statement is that in a 4D anchor tools theory, there exists an algebraic structure underlying the VPS sector. So this VPS algebra is not the it's not just the algebra acting on the VPS states, it's the algebra of the VPS states, meaning that the elements of the algebra are the VPS states, and the multiplication of the algebra are given by the some fusion of the VPS states. So this is analog of the chiral algebra of 2D anchor tool theory, and it is robust and control many aspects of the theory. So the question is, how do we construct this VPS algebra? So today, I will not derive this VPS algebra directly as a fusion of VPS state. And also, there's actually many different formulations of the algebra, and with a slightly different region of validity. For example, there's this COHA, and also the VOA, and also the Alpha-Yang inversion. So these are related by some basis changes and also the sub-algebra, etc. So today I will use this Alpha and Yangian formulation of the PPS algebra. And so I will try to derive this based on how they act on the PPS states. And this action is fixed by demanding that they will reproduce the fusion process. So this procedure will apply to any theory whose PPS sector can be described by some quiver quantum mechanics. So this applies in particular to the theory of type 2A string on general, sorry, I forgot the important word, not general Clavial, general Torrey Clavial, threefold, and the class S3. Sorry, here it's not general Clavial, just general Torrey. And this procedure allows you to write down the explicit relation very easily, like already written here. So we first did this just focusing on the type 2A on generic Torrey Clavial. So the half VPS sector is given by this anchor tool for quiver quantum mechanics with some quiver and superpotential. So for this theory, this quiver and superpotential pair are special in that they can repackage into a periodic quiver. And from this periodic quiver is possible to uplift this periodic quiver and then obtain a description of the BPS state in terms of certain three-dimensional colored crystal. So the color corresponds to the gauge factor in this quiver quantum mechanics. And then we fix the action of this algebra. And once you fix this action, you can bootstrap the algebra itself. So this is actually very efficient. And actually this idea, you can use this generalized to actually arbitrary quiver. So the difference for the arbitrary quiver is that you don't have this quiver superpotential, you don't have this periodic quiver description anymore. And the BPS state is just given by some ideal of this Jacobian algebra of the quiver and superpotential. But this idea still allows you to fix the action and then bootstrap the algebra. So you can do this too for arbitrary quiver and superpotential. So the advantage of this procedure is that you can easily write down explicit algebra relation. And this basis allows you to easily generalize to trigonometric and elliptic versions. And this is also a basis that make it very easy to describe all the non-vacuum representations. And they will allow you to describe other chambers and also include open BPS counting. So some applications that you can use this algebra to count the BPS state very efficiently as a character of the BPS algebras. So this also allows you to unify the BPS counting problem for different chambers. So basically, for the same theory, if you had a different chamber, they just correspond to different representation of the same algebra. And the counting works in the same way, and basically you can just put it in mathematical and run it. And you can also use this algebra to prove algebraically correspondence involving BPS sectors, such as AGT or gauge beta correspondence. So here's the plan. So I just finished the introduction. So I'll first explain how to describe this BPS states as the ideals of a certain Jacobian algebra that has a poset structure. And then I'll use this this description to bootstrap the algebra. And then I will describe the non-vacuum representations, and then I'll finish with some applications. So as I already mentioned, that today's focus is the series with hard BPS sectors given by N to 4 quiver quantum mechanics. For example, for the type 2A on Tourier Clabial threefold, the hard BPS sector is just given by the deep brains on the holomorphic even cycles of the threefold. And for the class S, it's given by the M2 ending on M5, which reduced down to the strain on the WKB curves. So today I will now explain how to derive this BPS quiver from the 4D theory. I'll just take the BPS quiver as an input. So the quiver is just the data of a certain bunch of vertices and the arrows between these vertices. So each vertex corresponds to a U-N gauge group, and each arrow corresponds to some chiral field that transforms as bifundamentals of the two U-N. And then there's also the superpotential. So it's just a So the superpotential is a bunch of monomials and with signs. So the derivative for the superpotential give you the F-term constraint. So here is some examples. So the first one is the one that corresponds to the type 2A on the C3. It just has one vertex and three arrows, and with this superpotential. And the next one is two vertices and then the two. Yeah, I do not use this pointer.
We have a hockey stick if
you need. I think you got it. Yes, at some point I saw the.
Do you see it?
Yeah, I come. Oh.
No, I point here?
Yes.
But do you see it?
I saw it at some point, but then it disappeared.
Okay, anyhow, so there the second example that I'm actually going to use a lot later is this type 2A unresolved conifold, which has two vertices and then two arrows goes this way and two arrows goes back. And then there's also this conical quiver. Because see, there's no self, there's no loop, so there's no superpotential here. So the claim is the BPS algebra for this is the given by the quiver union. So this is the focus of today. This bifundamental chiral field give you a representation of the quiver with these dimensions. So and then the chiral ring generated by this field is given by a representation of this Jacobian algebra, which is defined as a path algebra divided by the F-term constraints. So the path algebra is just you multiply the arrows in the quiver together according to the, I mean, you just multiply them together if the target of one is the same as if the head of the one is connecting to if the head of one is reaching the tail of the other. Anyhow, you know what I mean. You can only multiply if the vertices are matched, and then you have this F-term constraint given by the derivative of the superpotential. So this is just a quiver quantum mechanics. This is a quiver and a superpotential. And also you have to specify other data such as which chamber you're in and whether you have an open string, et cetera. So this is correspond to the specifying framing of the quiver.
Sorry, we have a question. So the Jacobian algebra appears when you take the ranks large. Finite ranks, there's gonna be some trace relations too, right?
Yeah, so I allow the rank to change.
I see, so you don't, you're not.
No, I don't fix the rank. So I mean, the whole thing is the point of whole thing is to look at the moduli space of the whole thing. So it's long. So the framing of a quiver is that to the original vertices of the quiver, you add an additional flavor vertex. So inside the original flavor, all the vertices correspond to the gauge field. So you add additional flavor vertex. I will label this by infinity, and then you also add new errors that going from this the new vertex to the original one, and then you also add some additional monomials to your superpotential. So physically, this framing will correspond to the, say, for example, in the type 2A, you add additional, you add 1D6, wrapping the entire club L3, and you can also add D4, wrapping either the holomorphic 4 cycles or the Lagrangian 3 cycles. And in the class S theory, correspond to the adding the additional BPS long operators. So the easiest framing, we'll call it a canonical framing, meaning that you have one flavor vertex, and then you just add one error from this new vertex to just one particular node. For example, in this case, so I will label that frame node by zero. And because here it's not introducing additional loops, so the superpotential doesn't change. So for the unframed quiver, we're considering this Jacobian algebra. So for the canonical framing, so because this framed vertex, this zero, become special here. So for this canonical framed case, so now instead of original Jacobian algebra, you basically consider a subalgebra that's given by projecting this original Jacobian algebra to the subset where it always start from the zero. So all the paths in this algebra start from zero. So this I will explain in more detail later. That for the general framing, this the algebra you're looking at is can be given by the superposition of a multiple the J A.
Could you explain a bit what a path algebra is?
Yeah. So you have all this arrows inside your Q1. So Q0 is all these A's. So the path algebra is you just multiply all the arrows together, but you can only multiply them if the head, the tail or the head. If the target of one arrow is the same as the source of the next one. So this will be non-zero. But say if you multiply this way, this will be zero. I mean, it's only non-zero if it's if this is matched.
I see.
Yeah. So sorry. Please stop me and ask questions. So for the last part is now it's hard to see, but hopefully it'll be clear later. Okay, so here's a summary. So we want to describe this hub BPS sector that has this quiver description and also has a given framing in terms of this Jacobian algebra. So this is built from the original full Jacobian algebra. So the statement is that a solution of this bifundamentals that satisfy the F-term constraint, D-term constraint with a certain rank, correspond to a representation of the this Jacobian algebra with the same dimension. And then there's some mathematical statement that this is actually equivalent to the ideal of this Jacobian algebra with the codimension n. So for the type 2A on Torre-Clavier 3 in this so-called non-commutative DT chamber, this is has a nice geometric description in terms of this 3D crystals. So here this solution, of course, so we're, in this case, we're looking at the D-brain bound state with certain charges. So there's one D6 and no D4, and some number of D0 and some D2s. So this will correspond to, so this ideal has, so this whole J0 has a description of some certain three-dimensional crystals that you can obtain from uplifting this periodic quiver that I mentioned earlier. And this ideal is some subset that satisfies some certain conditions. It's called molten crystal, meaning some crystal that's melted from this full crystal. Okay, so here it's hard to see, but you just later I will have pictures. So this is the easy case for the NCEDT chamber. And for the arbitrary chamber, the only thing you change is that instead of this 3D crystal that you uplift from the whole periodic quiver, you're looking at some subcrystals. And then everything else is the same. And then for the arbitrary quiver, you don't have this crystal description, but instead you just describe this this Jacobian algebra directly. I mean, it has some post-set structure. And then you can describe arbitrary chamber in the same spirit. So what I'll do, I'll try to explain this the case with this crystal description in detail, and then from there it's easy to see how to generalize to an arbitrary case. So for this type 2A on Torre-Clavier 3, we consider this BPI sector given by the this one D6 and a bunch of D2 and D0, and the wall volume theory on this intersection of the D-brains is given by the Encq2-4 quiver quantum mechanics. And so you translate this Torre data to the quiver data using, for example, this brain tiling techniques. And so in this case, the special thing is that in the superpotential, each bifundamental appear exactly twice in all these terms. So once with the plus sign and once with minus sign. So this condition make, for example, this is the example that I'm going to discuss a lot. So this is Torre-Clavier and this corresponding quiver and superpotential. So this condition on the superpotential make it possible for us to package this quiver and superpotential in the data for a periodic quiver. So this means that you just draw this you draw this quiver on a T2 or periodically on a R2, and then inside the fundamental domain, each phase. So you draw in such a way that inside each phase, all the arrows point in the same direction. So along the each phase is a loop, and then each phase in the fundamental domain corresponds to a term inside in this superpotential. So it's like here. And then this orientation of the loop corresponds to the sign of that term. So I'll explain a bit in more detail how this how to see that they should be uplift to a 3D crystal. So here this is example. So we first choose a framed vertex. Let's choose it to be 0. And then in this periodic quiver, you choose just one particular vertex with this color 0. So that will be your origin. So here I only draw a small part of this periodic quiver. You should think of this as infinite in R2. And then now, so now we because this is path algebra, so we're considering the path that's starting from this O, this this origin, and we just call that path atom. I mean, it just I don't know, because later we want to say crystal, so you call this atom. But you remember that it's a path. So this is the first path that is just has no length. It just go from zero and then stay at zero to zero. So that's the first atom. And then the second one is zero goes to this one that has color one. So zero is blue and one is red. So the second atom is red. And then the this next one is going from zero. So this is the path.
So, do you remind me why you can
start from zero? I want to start with one particular vertex. That's the easiest. So that's the.
Is there motivation to do so?
So I can consider arbitrary framing, and then I want to describe. So later.
Yeah, there was a question. I can't understand the relation between putting a framing vertex at zero. Because you're looking at mesons?
Let me finish. So I'm allowed to, I can talk about arbitrary framing, but as you can, but you haven't finished yet. So it's easiest to describe first the simple case where you start from one.
Tell me again by framing effect, which parts you're looking at.
So here this framing vertex correspond to the in this case it correspond to the 1d6 or maybe some d4, but in this this basically course describe how all these other d2 and d0 bound to this d6. So I mean, this is just the simplest case where I want to start from zero.
Right, so I'm trying to understand. Are you looking at paths modulo cyclic?
Yes.
Or you're just looking back at the beginning and at the end, and then.
I'm looking at here in the simplest case. I'm looking at all the paths that start from zero.
Yes, and do you keep track of the paths that start from zero?
Yes.
Like 0, 1, 0, 1, 1. 0, 1, 1, that's different from 0, 1, 1, 0, 1.
Sorry, I can't, let me write down what you said. So you want to consider what?
Before framing,
yeah, I can start. Yes.
Forgetting the beginning of the path.
Yes.
Because these are traces. When you say count paths, you really mean I'm counting, and you say Jacobi ring, right? You're counting elements in the Jacobi ring.
Yes.
So the closed paths without the beginning will be traces of products of matrices.
Yes.
Now, here instead you're starting from zero, and it matters that you're starting from zero. Does it mean that you're looking at mesonic operators in the Jacobi ring or the frame quiver?
So I'm always looking at the paths that start from zero. I mean, I label anything from No, it's me again.
So you have some fields here, some of which are the framing arrow, and I would call mesons, which are like fundamentals for zero, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the bifundamentals, which are the other arrows. So should I think that you're starting with a fundament, with an anti-fundamental, then a bunch of matrices?
No, I only look at the bifundamental. Here, I just.
But if that was the case, then it would not matter the cyclic ordering. But if the cyclic ordering matter, then you cannot be looking at traces. You must be looking at mesonic operators. At the very fact that staying at zero and not moving, you consider as something non-trivial. Agrees with what I'm saying, because that would be the
actually it's very hard measure. It's very hard for me to hear what you're actually saying. So is
the
it possible
very fact that you consider staying at zero as a non-trivial element suggests that staying at zero means
a bilinear of the fundamental fields. Is that reasonable to you?
Sorry, staying at zero or starting? Okay. I just can't hear you with the mask.
So here you have various fields, right? A, B, C, and then you have this training vertex. So there will be some F and F bar fields here.
No, I don't have an F bar. I don't go back.
Again, you're counting on elements in the Jacobi ring.
Yes.
How could staying at zero be an element?
Sorry, staying or starting?
You drew a box, right? And you said this is non-trivial and corresponds to staying at zero. Is that correct?
Okay. So maybe I should say that I introduce another element that other element 0 to 0.
Are we still counting elements in some Jacobi ring?
Yes. Maybe I introduce another one that act as a projection operator. So I start from this
why
one.
Why would you just not put F bar F? That's already a projection operator. Why do you need to add something if you already have F bar and F?
So here I don't have this
zero to zero. Element one, right?
Yes.
This would be F bar F. And then, I don't know, the thing you were drawing here would be F bar A, B, F, right? Or something like that.
But I'm not going F. No,
or do you start, or do you go from zero somewhere else and you stop somewhere else?
So this one has no B.
Ah, okay. So what is it if you go to B and you stop?
Yeah, I stop there. I mean, that gave me another pass.
Cut that here?
No, that's what I said.
But then what
there's only, I'm only.
It's not gauge invariant. How can I go to one and stop there? So you're not counting elements of the Jacobi ring.
I'm not.
Are you counting elements of the Jacobi ring?
Yes. So okay.
But then how can you stop at one?
So, okay, so this is given by all this, the paths.
So
then,
when you say Jacobi ring, did you enforce gauge invariant? Perhaps I missed that. Were you looking at gauge invariant operators or just?
She didn't.
No.
Okay. So there was no gauge invariant whatsoever.
Yes. I'm looking.
Why are you drawing the quiver?
Why am I drawing the?
You said there was N1 and Shu and so on. I mean, when you talk about deep, what's the meaning in a deep brain system?
You mentioned quiver quantum mechanics.
Yes.
I think the confusion is, you know, if you want to think about this as quiver quantum mechanics, an open path doesn't make any sense. It's not gauge invariant.
It's not the gauge invariant.
So
you can't talk about
right. So. Yeah. But I'm allowing, so I have additional operator that change the rank. If that's, I mean, all these operators allow you to change the rank. So in some sense, I'm looking at the whole moduli space.
They're not gauge invariant to go from 0 to 1 and stop.
So, but I'm introducing this. I'm not staying inside one quiver quantum mechanics that with a fixed rank.
It doesn't matter whatever is the rank. The element A is not gauge invariant, no matter what the ranks are.
Okay, so?
I'm just trying to understand what you're doing. Right? You're counting something, but I don't know what you're counting. You can tell me.
I'm counting the. Okay. Okay, if I fix rank, then it's some given quantum mechanics with a fixed rank. But now I'm looking at the whole moduli space.
You mentioned the Fermi node, but what is the Fermi node doing besides saying pointing at zero? Like you put the Fermi node, but you don't include the fields for it, so what's the point?
So, I mean, so right now it just tells me that it starts from zero, but it can also make it start, go somewhere else.
You have some rules, but I don't understand the relationship between those rules. And the quantum mechanics. You said you were talking about this quiver quantum mechanics, but then you do things which don't seem to be related to the quiver quantum mechanics. They seem to be related to the quiver, but not to the quiver quantum mechanics. I mean, you're describing something which is purely combinatorial, but I don't understand if there is any physics.
No, but if I look at the moduli space of this quantum mechanics, so where I can change the rank, then this algebra would come into play.
An element of the quantum mechanics is not an operator in the quantum mechanics.
Yeah, as I said, I introduce additional operators that separate two quantum mechanics with a different rank.
It does not matter. A is not an element of that still.
So A is not the...
What are you counting?
No, so A...
Just tell me what you're counting in the quantum mechanics. Some...
I'm counting the states that... Sorry. I mean, do this thing here. I'm counting some solution of this these bifundamentals, which correspond to representation of this J. And then this translate into this ideal.
So I'm counting classical solutions. Okay, sorry.
I'm counting solution that satisfy this F-term and D-term constraint. And
so how does a path count the solution? Because perhaps I just messed it. I missed this crucial step.
Yeah. Okay. The crucial step is that this representation can be translated into the ideal of this J. That's a crucial point. So first, I describe this J in terms of all these arrows, and then I'm looking at the ideals. So in this case, there's this one-to-one map from the representation to the ideal.
Does the ideal include the relation which composes cyclic invariance?
Yes, that's inside this J. That's inside this J, right? The J contains these relations. J is modeling out all these F-term constraints.
But not those F-term constraints, and there's also the constraint that the path has to be closed.
Okay, I don't need the path to be closed.
But then how do you...
So in the past algebra, does the path have to close?
No. Help me understand what ideal corresponds with you.
What ideal?
You're counting ideals, so can you just describe for me one of the ideals you're counting?
One of the ideals I'm counting? Oh, okay, so think of this as some infinite thing that, so this is the origin. And then in this three direction is infinite. So the ideal is something that, so if you remove one, so this, the remaining bit, this is ideal.
Sorry, I'm just not nimble enough to convert a picture into an ideal. Perhaps you could just give me a hint of how to do so.
Okay, so this is the one particular element inside your J. And do you agree that if this is one element?
I'm just really slow. Can you just help me a second to understand how to go from a picture like that to an element of J?
So here's just, if you go from there, so like the position of the box forms a basis for functions of three variables.
Okay.
And like the ideal is those, you know. So if you draw a picture like that, I just look at the collection of basis elements which are in that region. That's an ideal.
For C3.
For C3.
No, this is not C3. Sorry, this case.
Generalization, I assume.
Okay.
Isn't that right?
Yes. I mean, this is the ideal for this case. I mean, if for the C3, just forget about the color.
Yeah. This is, no. It's like the fixed points of the torus action of the Hilbert
space. Yes.
Are given by its boxes. And literally, you get the ideal by looking at the complement of your.
Okay, and what's the relation between these ideals and paths in the quiver?
Okay, the path of the quiver gives you this this J. Now I'm looking at the ideals.
No, but see, in situ mo situ, X is not a function.
What is X?
So we have X, Y, and Z, right? The three coordinates, or A, B, C.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So A is not a function.
It's not, what do you mean a function? So, okay, so each of these boxes correspond to a path. Do you agree with that? So,
I'm trying to follow the idea that these boxes represent a function. And for C3, I understand it, like one is the function x or y or xy or x squared y squared z cubed.
So x, y, z is the three arrows?
Yes. Oh,
okay.
ABC, I'm happy to call them ABC. So,
no, just x, y, z, that's fine.
X, y, z. Okay, so if I'm in C2 mod C2 times C,
yes.
All the coordinates on C2, x and y, and the third one, b, did I?
No. So,
no.
Okay. So, in C3, you call this x. This is x, y,
yes.
Z, right? So in the C2 mod Z2 called C,
yes.
The action is A1, I forgot, A1, A2, B1, B2, B1, B2, and this direction is C.
Okay, but so which function corresponds to A?
Which function? So, okay, here, which function corresponds to X? X is arrow.
The function X.
Then the A.
But,
I mean, so here you're looking at all the, I mean, you're looking at, I mean, the products X, Y, Z. X,
so
Y. I'm not sure. I mean, the function, yeah, you can talk about the function, but it has to follow. I mean, you can only multiply them if they are if you're allowed to multiply them.
Just like,
I'm not sure whether you can.
You made her skip several slides.
No, go back, it's fine. I just accept that I don't understand what's going on.
No. Sorry, but if you remember, I'm happy to just use. You just forget about these colors.
I just like to know what you're talking about. Once I know what you're talking about, I'm happy
but,
to follow.
Yeah, I'm happy to explain if I. I'm happy to explain if I know exactly where is your confusion is. Do you understand, Kevin?
Yeah.
So what's the confusion here?
Well, I think the confusion is what has what you're doing really got to do with N equals 4 quantum mechanics?
Yeah, that will really help. Absolutely. So why in which quantum mechanical problem I find myself counting ideals?
We want to consider this whole moduli space. I mean, how
mechanics, I don't study a moduli space.
But I want to study the moduli space.
But then you're not doing pure
quantum
mechanics, which
is
fine.
It's just the moduli space, you know, solutions to the equations of motion of the classical system is this module. What is the moduli space of sheaves?
Yes.
And
so, I mean, so you have to allow me to change the rank. I mean, this E generator or F generator basically allow you to jump, so you can't just stay in one quantum mechanics. It's the same quantum mechanics.
Yes, there's interfaces.
Yes, there's interfaces.
Usually boundary condition.
Yes. I mean, you have to allow me to change the rank. You have to go outside this, just one quantum mechanics. I'm counting the states inside this moduli space.
There is probably something about some words about covariant homology or something that would really help me and just get an idea of what you're doing. But
if you're familiar with the C3 case.
But I'm not.
I'm
not familiar with the C3 case. I have no idea still.
But you're familiar with the plane partition.
Yes.
So inside plane partition, there's all these boxes.
No, I understand. I'm familiar with combinatorics. The physical meaning of the combinatorics is still not very transparent to me. So I know people do things.
So
I don't know why they do them. So I can enjoy the combinatorics, but I'm really having trouble pinning down the physical meaning of what's going on, which makes it difficult for me.
So
if somebody could tell me, you know, which physical problem is controlled by counting 3D partitions, I would be very happy.
By counting the plane partition, I'm counting the number of D0 configuration that's bound to D6.
What does those words mean? Why are D0 configurations something I can count?
So
what does the zero configuration mean to you?
I'm counting the D0 bound states into one D6 in this chamber. So that's the BPS counting is given by this Mike Mahon function.
Do you have equivalent quantum mechanics and
so for if you fix the rank, if I have phi D0 and then there's some certain number of different configurations. So if I fix the rank, I have one particular quantum mechanics.
So
but I'm changing the rank, so I'm looking at the entire modulized space. Of this problem.
Tell me what you're doing with that. And what are you looking at? More like space of classical configurations of these planes, like derived covariant sheaves or something. Are you quantum mechanics? What is going on?
I'm looking at the torics fixed point of this modulized space.
Okay. And these, which are mathematical entities, what do they mean? Is it perhaps some kind of quantum mechanics with Euclidean of some sort?
I could say the Hilbert space of this quantum mechanical system
is
the cohomology of the modulated shapes.
Okay.
So the torus fixed points form a basis for that.
For the Euclidean cohomology. Okay, thank you.
So that's the quantum mechanics with some point.
Okay. And then these interfaces are things between operators on this.
Exactly. Okay. It's my large N. You don't see the difference in right, so they're really like they kind of ionic operators.
Now, is there any intuitive way to understand why the states are counted by weavers, by paths on the weaver? Or that's just combinatorics?
Sir, it's not just, it can't be just a combinatorics. Nothing is just combinatorics.
Okay,
what's the question again?
So, suppose that it's quantum mechanics, and you compute, which computes the covariant homology of the model space of sheaves with some quantum number, whatever. Why the counting of these states, or these equivalent fixed points, is related to paths on the quiver?
I think that maybe the main missing link, maybe the main point for you is this part from the from the module, the identification of the from the module to the.
That's very likely. That's
crucially helpful. I don't have a physical intuition why this is true.
I see. So the moment is combinatorics, if somebody computed.
I'm not sure this level is combinatorics. So.
It's a mathematical result.
It's a mathematical result that.
You cannot give me a transparent physical meaning.
Yeah. Right. So that one I don't have a physical understanding for that.
And I'll have to just accept.
Okay. So.
So
yeah. So you just have to.
At the moment, that's just combinatorics. But when you say framing, I still want to know the question. Answer the question. So if I frame the quiver now, I'm adding stuff to the quantum mechanics, right? And I'm studying
yes.
The quantum mechanics.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And these are ideas for that quantum mechanics.
This is the ideal for this J that describes the modulized space of that quantum mechanics.
Yeah, including the framing arrows.
Including the framings.
So there are fundamental fields and all of that.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay. So yeah, okay. Maybe you'll ask me more later. So now we accept that we want to consider the ideals. So to do that, we want to describe this Jacobian algebra first. So we're looking at the path. So in order to picture this, I call this I draw this path by this atom. So for each atom, you should remember that they correspond to a path that's start from the origin in this case. So so because for atom here, that you can, there's multiple paths that that can reach there. So there's a notion of this path equivalence. And then we also have this notion of the depths. The depths give you the number of a closed loop in the path. So for example, this atom has a depth 0 that is close to the surface of the crystal. And then in this figure, all these atoms, they all have a depth 0. And then I add this additional blue box that will be has depth 1. So I just continue this way, and then I can grow an infinite crystal. I call this a full crystal here. So now I want to look at the ideal of this J. So the ideal is just a subset of these atoms with a path that if I multiply by another path, it stays inside this set. So you can see that because this path always have to start from the original piece, so if I remove some near this origin, and in this set, all the arrows can only point me into this, so it stay inside this ideals. So because this is a bit, so this ideal is infinite, so it's a bit unwieldy, so I want to look at the complement this ideal. So all this complement, so they call this the molten crystal. So I'll probably just call this finite complement crystal in the future. So you see, because I want to get the ideal, so there has to be some rules to take this out. So you have to take this near from the origin. So this is they call this here it should be melting rule. Subject to melting rule. So, and then if you think about how to grow this finite crystal, so the complement of the melting rule should be it's an adding rule. So okay, sorry. So this word should be melting. So this adding rule is that. So now I focus on the finite crystal that's near the tip. So the adding rule is that to add an atom, all its precursor has to be already inside the crystal. So the precursor is just any atom that has an arrow pointing to this the atom. For example, in this case, all these three atoms has a precursor already inside, so they are allowed. And in contrast, this configuration is not allowed because this blue atom has two red atoms as a precursor. So only one of them in, so then this is not allowed. So for example, if you have this both two red atoms in, this configuration is allowed. So now we want to add more. So from this, we want to assign the equivalent weight to these atoms. So first we assign the weight for each pass. So this weight of the atom is just given by the sum of the weight along this path. And then this path equivalence just correspond to the constraint that the sum of the weight along this path has to vanish. And this depth just says that if you project this down, the atom have the same position when you project it down, have the same weight. And so then you can count how many, after you're taking into all these constraints, and also you're allowed to include some vertex constraint that correspond to the gauge symmetry. And after you count all this, for this Torrey-Clavier case is always just the two parameters correspond to the two equivalent parameters for the Clausius three. So in this case, you can just count. So in the first box has one configuration. The one with the one blue one and one red one has two possibility, and then so you just count this. So this you can translate into the number of D2 and D0. So this will give you a way to, you can count the BPS partition function by counting this generating function of the crystals. So you can do this for arbitrary Clausius 3. For example, this is the conical case. The full crystal is in the shape of the pyramid. And this case is more difficult because it's a closed four cycle. But it's given by this three-colored plane partition. For example, this is the full crystal and the molten crystal. And you can check that this reproduces the generating function here. So for the general quiver, the only thing that changes that is that we don't have this 3D crystal structure because we can't package this quiver and superpotential into a periodic quiver. So we just have to use the language that we just directly talk about this J. And then we can still call this pass the atom. And then this molten crystal is just some complement of the ideal of this J. It's just some certain element of the pole set. For example, this is the double quiver of the alpha and E6 Dinkin diagram. And you see this J has this pole set structure. So this is the empty one. This P0 is just the zero starting from the infinity. And then starting from zero, the next one, you can either have a zero back to zero goes to zero or zero go to six. And then next one, you can go from, you can have a 0, 6, 3 or 0, 6 and 0, 0 or 0, 0 and 0, 0, 0. I mean, you just run this. So any question before I move on to the algebra?
Okay, have you decided which one is the non-zero?
How do I what?
Have you decided which one is the non-zero?
How what? Say louder.
You're framing the node zero.
I choose to frame zero. I can choose other. I can start from any.
Okay.
I can start from any of them.
So this correspond to this P6. So is
it
zero.
So.
Or not?
I didn't draw the framing here. So this quiver itself is the double quiver of the alpha E6. Okay. So here I'm writing on this pole set, but. Here, this is correspond to the framing that's framed to this zero.
I'm just trying to remember physically what different framings correspond to. We're talking about this zero, it should be six.
Sorry. This is not that case anymore. This is not from the Torrey Clausius. This is some general quiver here. Okay, so if there's no other question, I will just move on to the how you can bootstrap this the algebra. So remember, this algebra is defined as the fusion of the PPI states. So here, instead of this looking at the arbitrary fusion of any two states, I look at the a fusion between one unit and an arbitrary state.
Would it be terrible if I ask what fusion means in the language of ideas?
You can ask this later after I finish this slides. So that fusion, that's too complicated to consider. So instead, I just imagine a process that I fuse an arbitrary state with a unit. So by unit, so this unit, is defined as I define some PPIS algebra acting on this on the Hilbert space. So I will define a raising operator that increases PPIS state by some unit, and then also Catan and lowering operator. And then I fix the action of this operator on any state. So this action is fixed by the demand that I want to, in the end, reproduce the fusion process. And once I fix these actions, I can fix all the I try to find all possible relations. And then the PPIS algebra is given by the free algebra generated by this generators divided by all the relations. So because it's PPIS states in general is infinite dimensional, I expect it's also the algebra to be infinite dimensional. So I organize, there's also some other intuition that I organize them by this one parameter called spectral parameter this way. So now I want to fix the action. So this is the ansatz we wrote down. And so the thing is that I want to define the red bit, the eigenvalue of the Catan, and then the coefficient of raising and lowering operator.
Sorry. Yes? What's the meaning of the spectral parameter? Is it an equivariant parameter? Jeeves?
The H itself. The equivariant parameter is inside this H, the H.
So there's some relationship.
Yes. I mean, for all the purpose here, it's just a formal parameter that organizes all these algebras. So I want to fix this all the red things in such that I can actually realize this. This fusion. So for example, I want to make sure that all the final state, they're still allowed PPIS states. For example, in this case, if the initial state has these two boxes, the final state of the E operator can only be these three possible states there. And the final state of the F operator is this the blue box there. So how do I realize? So I mean, this is just ansatz I write down, and so this is getting the inspiration from this C3 case, which is already written down. So the most crucial part is this eigenvalue of this Catan is get contribution from the older atoms inside your state. And also you see this the coefficient, they are proportional to the residues. So we want the poles to correspond to either the place you can add atom or the place you can remove atom. So we want to define. So we have only one thing that left unfixed, which is this bounding factor here. We want to define it such that you get only the necessary poles. There's no redundant poles. So also you have this function that from the ground state, from the framing part. So here this I just want one single pole that corresponds to the place that you can start from the first atom. And so here's the main result. This bounding factor has a bunch of factors in the denominator correspond to the arrows going from B to A, and then the numerator correspond to some all the arrows from A to B. Anyhow, this is the prescription that works. So I can show why it works with these examples.
Okay. So the alpha and negative GL1 has an OR matrix and is a Hopf algebra.
The alpha and negative GL1 has what?
It has an OR matrix satisfying a Maxwell equation, and it has a coproduct.
Yes.
So do those structures happen in general, or is that a special thing?
I think that's not in general. I don't think that works for the chiral quiver. I think it works I'm not sure whether it works for all the symmetric quivers, but it certainly work for this one. It works basically for all the alpha and yang of some G. When there's the underlying Lie algebra structure. Yeah, so here you don't see the coproduct here yet. So here this the example we explained earlier. You have this periodic quiver and then this loop constraint. And this is some example of a state here. So this is the building block here. You write down all these possible bounding factors, and you have this ground state contribution here. So now we can check this, we checked that it's cyclic. It has all the necessary poles, and also it has no redundant poles. For example, you start from vacuum, you write down the charge function, and you look at what poles it has. So it has a pole for the zero. So that corresponds to the fact that you can apply E0 and give you the first atom. And because it's only one pole, that means you can't use it for the F anymore. So F annihilates vacuum. And then this, the next state, you again you write down this psi, and it has two poles. So the first one is correspond to the pole where you can annihilate this box and back to the vacuum. And the second box corresponds to the fact you can create another box. And then the blue one, so there's just two poles correspond to the two places where you can add the red atom. So red is one and blue is zero. And then the first interesting case come from this state. So this is the initial state, and you look at the charge function for zero. You see that there are two poles that correspond to these two final states, and then if you want to add this one, it's not possible because that pole is not there. So this just corresponds to the adding rule that we mentioned earlier, that all the precursor has to be there. So if you want to add this one, you have to have another state as your initial state. So you see that will provide you with additional pole that you allowed, you can use to add this blue. So it's all automatic. Yeah, anyhow, this is just how it works. So you see that all this is automatically implemented if you use this prescription. So one application that I might mention later is that by counting this pole, it's a very efficient way to compute the BPS partition function. So now you know the action of one generator. So now you just apply the operator twice, and then you change the order, you compare them, and then you write down all the quadratic relations. So they're very simple there. So the first one applied to is their universal for any quiver, and then the information of the quiver only show up in this the last four relations. So you can also use action to read off the range of the mode expansion. This EF is always, that's universal. And then this mode relation of the Cartan generator depends on whether the quiver is chiral or non-chiral, because that corresponds to whether the bounding factors are homogeneous or inhomogeneous. And for the Torrey-Clavier case, they correspond to the fact whether they are without a compact force cycle or with a compact force cycle. So very often you want to have the relation in terms of mode. So then you just plug in this mode expansion and then expand. Similar to the relation between the how you get the mode relation from the OPE. So yeah, you just do this. And then we also want higher order relations. So that would so higher relation, for example, give you all these serrelations. So you will know that you found all the relations once the vacuum character can reproduce a generating function of all the crystals. So it's still an open problem to classify all the higher order relations for general quivers. So here's some special cases. So for this type of class of Torrey-Clavier, the quivers look like this, and you get the alpha and yang neighbor this super Lie algebra GL M/N. And where the, you can have the double quiver of the ADE Dinkin diagrams. And for this case, this is also equivalent to the universal enveloping algebra of the W1 plus infinity or the G extended W1 plus infinity. And this is also, you just, you change this rational function in the bounding factor into some function. You change the rational factor into the sinh factor or theta function. Then you get a toroidal and elliptic version. I think I'm running way over time. So I have, I have to this non-vacuum representation that corresponds to the other framing. So it depends on what you guys want.
So maybe let's give a, firstly, give a round of applause for anybody who has to leave earlier, but a vote on whether we want to learn more about. Maybe just a summary.
Yeah, I mean, there's not much mystery here. It's just different framing give you a different shape. And this you can, from this shape, you can see that you can have the different superposition of the canonical case. And this gets translated into the vacuum part of the chart function. And then you just start from there, and everything goes through. That's it. And I mean, you can do other chambers or have open BPS states. So questions?
Sorry, I have another question. So the construction of the COA starts kind of similar ingredients, because they're also looking at the moduli space of sheaves and the toric on the clavier. People like to go to this non-commutative DT chamber. And they have operators which add and remove things. So you would hope that they're the same. So can you guys prove that your algebra is the COA? Is this?
I think the COA doesn't have the Cartan, right? I think the COA only have the E part. Yes, only the positive part.
Yes, of course. We expect it should be a subalgebra.
Yes.
Can you prove that?
Not sure. I think there's some. I mean, for the GLN case, I think there's some proof by Fagin in one of their papers in 2015.
Yeah. So I know for the GL1 case, for the kind of the cases with compact four cycles are the hard cases.
I'm not sure whether you can call it a proof, but I think there's some arguments, even for the case with the compact four cycle.
That would be great, because they can't compute anything.
They can compute anything.
It's almost impossible for them to compute anything at all. This is much better that way.
You happier? You happier?
I'm waiting for the end of the seminar. I just don't know. I would really love to know what's going on.
Let's have lunch over it then.
Well, I have to go to some events.
Okay.
This is the picture Dima draw for this gauge beta thing. It's the fun part. You start from this quiver gauge here, and then before they see that there's this vacuum equation that have the shape, have the form of the beta ansatz. And it's hard to understand. So this dotted part is how, it's not clear how to understand this. So then you can go this way. You can look at this BPS algebra, and you define the coproducts, and then you get a chain. It's not a spin chain. You have a chain of crystals. And from there, you get the armatures, and you solve the Young-Basler equation, and you derive this. But there's all this dangerous part. This is all this, the the tentacle of this this octopus were quite long. Yeah, I will just end with this picture.